Hi, my name's Melanie Cheng, and I'm the author of The Burrow.
Melanie Cheng's novel, The Burrow, is a slim and beautifully written book about a family dealing with grief in the midst of the COVID-19 lockdown in Australia, with each family member exploring the mistakes they've made within their role in the family. I recently spoke with Melanie Cheng about the rotating perspectives in the book and the connection between her story and her real life. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goulet, and here's my conversation with Melanie Cheng. Can you give our listeners a description of The Burrow?
Yeah, The Burrow follows the Lee family, which comprises Jin, the father, an emergency doctor, his wife Amy, who's the mother of the story and who is herself an aspiring writer, and their 10-year-old daughter, Lucy. And this is a family ravaged by grief as a result of a horrible tragedy that occurred 4 years prior to us meeting them. And into this stagnant and sad household arrive two visitors, one in the form of their newly adopted pet mini Lop rabbit, and the other slightly less welcome arrival of Pauline, who is Amy's mother and who has been estranged from the family since the accident. And The Burrow tells the story of this grieving family who are forced to confront the circumstances around their terrible loss and follows them as they pursue a path to healing.
So the book is told not through, you know, a chorus of voices necessarily, but through a rotation of viewpoints. You mentioned these four characters, Jin, Amy, Lucy, and Pauline. And what is the perspective? Is it third person limited?
It would be third person limited.
Yeah. And so what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of telling a story through this perspective?
So I think I really enjoy jumping in to a different character's heads. And I think that comes from my apprenticeship in writing through short stories. So my first book was a collection of short stories, and I've always enjoyed, you know, taking on a completely different perspective and looking at an event from a multitude of different perspectives. So I think the advantage of that is that the reader gets to experience, you know, different takes on an event. But the disadvantage as the author is that it can be tricky to do, to inhabit so many different viewpoints when, you know, obviously I only have my own lived experience to draw upon. So the way I kind of got around that for the Burrow was that each character holds similarities to myself. So Jin, he has a Chinese background, as do I. He's a doctor, and I am a healthcare worker also. I work as a family practitioner in Australia. Amy, the mother, is a writer, so I share that characteristic with her, and she's a mother. Lucy, the 10-year-old, I have a daughter, so I have some insights into what it's like to be a 10-year-old now. But also Lucy is very similar to how I was as a young child, quite introverted and bookish. Pauline is perhaps the character that is least like me in some ways. I joke that perhaps she's the woman I'm growing into. But of course, she is not my mother, but she is of that generation. So I guess I also did draw on, you know, the chats and conversations I have with my mother about, you know, her kind of take on contemporary society. And I've certainly probably used a little bit of that in Pauline's character. But yeah, it's a lot of fun not being limited to one perspective as we are in reality and life. And for me, that's part of the enjoyment of writing, that freedom to explore different points of view.
You know, I was curious about Lucy's perspective because, like you said, she's 10 years old and she feels very average, remarkably unremarkable and sometimes invisible. And, you know, lately she's been imagining the death of her loved ones, you know, quite vividly. So not only did you have to assume the perspective of a 10-year-old, but it was just, you know, not just any 10-year-old, but one who has to navigate living in a COVID lockdown with miserable parents. Were you able to glean some of the, I mean, I don't want to put that on your daughter.
Well, as it turns out, you know, the book is set in Melbourne and I live in Melbourne. And for a while there, we were the most locked down city in the world, not a title that we rejoiced in, you know, having. So it was really tough here for us for a while. There was a lot of homeschooling. I was working as a healthcare worker during that time, with all the demands that that had on us. And so I certainly could relate to that kind of bleakness. Much of that was drawn from our own experience. And my daughter was about 10 during that, in 2020, when the book is set. And so I did observe, you know, the difficulties around the lockdown for a child of that age. But Lucy is, of course, quite different to my own daughter, who missed a lot of the social interactions from school. Lucy, because she is naturally quite introverted and doesn't have a lot of friends at school, for her, there is some relief and reprieve, actually, in homeschooling. And she, you know, conveys that in the book, that she quite enjoys being able to get all her work done in the first few hours of the day and then spend the rest of the day reading and lounging around and playing with her new pet rabbit.
You know, we begin the book 4 years after the tragedy, like you mentioned, and we are in one of Jen's chapters. He's driving the deserted streets of the pandemic, picking up the rabbit, and he's listening to the Carnival of the Animals, which captured my attention because I love that music. And then Watership Down makes an appearance. And then Lucy, I think it was in a different Jen chapter, he commented that Lucy was carrying a thick and dog-eared paperback. And I thought, oh, what book's going to be revealed now? But it stopped with Watership Down. So talk to me about the importance of that book in this story.
Yeah, since touring the book in Australia, I've realized how divided people are about the book Watership Down. Some people are still quite traumatized from the reading experience, and others, like me, quite love the book. So for me, growing up, I did really enjoy Watership Down. I think it came to me at the right age. So I was probably around 11 or 12 when I read it. And interestingly, I've since found out that Richard Adams, the author, actually had a lot of trouble publishing Watership Down because it was felt to be, you know, too adult for children and a little bit too childlike for adults. So, you know, publishers were wondering, well, who is going to read this book? Who's the target market? Well, perhaps it was a child like me, because I was in that kind of in-between age, you know, 11, you know, and quite bookish. So I'd like to read up, you know, that book really stretched me in terms of dark themes and the vocabulary. And so I really relished that experience. And so when I came to writing a book about a rabbit, it seemed natural to include it. But also I wanted to create this connection between Pauline, the grandmother, and Lucy, and it seemed perfect for them to bond over a book because, you know, that's how I bonded with my mum and how, you know, I see my own parents bonding with my children through the act of reading. And in fact, you know, there are these conduits in this family which provide this opportunity for reconnection and healing in a kind of non-confronting way. So, you know, in the burrow, all these individual characters are quite siloed off from each other and they're, you know, nursing these wounds, and they have a lot of guilt and shame about this terrible tragedy that occurred. But the rabbit and books and even traveling in cars kind of all focused on the, you know, distant road ahead of them rather than looking at each other, provide these kind of non-confrontational opportunities for them to start to reconnect with each other. And so I loved being able to incorporate the act of reading and sharing books into the burrow, which, because it was such an important part of my life growing up as well.
When Pauline reread the book as an adult, she was disappointed. Did you have the same reaction?
Well, yeah, so as I was writing The Burrow, I decided, well, of course, I'm going to have to revisit this book. And because, so many adults talk about the book being kind of this traumatic experience, I guess I was bracing myself for that again. And similar to Pauline, I was kind of, a bit underwhelmed by the violence in a way. I think maybe when you are a child and it's perhaps the first time you're encountering some of that kind of, totalitarianism and, injustice and violence. Now as a kind of experienced, perhaps disillusioned adult, it didn't strike me in the same way. And so I wanted to bring that to Pauline's experience. I still love the book, but I wonder if some of these adults I'm talking to now, if they went back and read it, that they would also realize, oh, perhaps it's not as awful as I remember.
So the rabbit they adopt, which they name Fiver after one of the rabbits in the book in Watership Down, the rabbit helps distract the Lees a bit from their sadness, and Lucy develops quite an affinity for it. And I want to talk about the title and the idea of a burrow. And I mean, the family was protecting this rabbit hutch first, with bars to keep the cats and foxes away, and then with chicken wire to prevent rats from coming in, and then with mosquito netting to protect the rabbit from mosquito bites. And this is a quote from one of Amy's chapters. When she stood back to appraise her work, she was struck by the absurdity of what she was doing. All these nets and wires and filigree solutions, for what? The protection of a prey animal who, in the wild, would simply bury himself in the ground. And it seemed like there were a lot of layers of metaphor happening here, the burrowing in during COVID lockdown, perhaps, and also the building up of layers of protection from grief. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There's another chapter in which I think it might be Amy is also reflecting on, the way we baby-proof a house when we first have our children. And of course, I did that too, putting soft corners on coffee tables and putting gates on the top and bottom of stairs. And, it's all these measures to anticipate tragedy and accidents and then prevent them. And that's what they're doing again with the rabbit, trying to anticipate all the dangers that exist and do something to prevent them. And yet this is a family who, of course, have already suffered the most horrible and tragic of losses, and they didn't prevent that loss. And so while they're still in the habit of trying to control the uncontrollable, they also know that even when you do all of that, it's not fail safe. So this is really a family who have observed firsthand the kind of brutal cruelty of the universe. And deep down, I think they know that as much as you do, nothing is fail safe. And they have to live with that uncertainty and that fear. And I think, they are burying themselves in their home, in their individual kind of personal grief, and they're hiding. And Lucy does that regularly when there's, any family arguments, for instance, she goes and runs away and hide, which is very similar, of course, to what a prey animal does. And that was something that struck me because my own family did take in a mini lop rabbit during the early phase of the pandemic. One of the things that surprised me about caring for this animal was just how hypervigilant a creature it is. I mean, because I think we get used to the more traditional pets of cats and dogs, who of course are predators, and so they do get to sleep and relax in a way that prey animals do not. And to have that experience of caring for a prey animal during 2020, when I myself was quite not sleeping for very long and also feeling quite hypervigilant, it was this, great mirror on my own anxieties. And I thought it would be great to kind of explore that through writing.
Beyond the rabbit, Fiver. It felt like there were some other animal-themed moments in the book. You know, Pauline was petting a rabbit and watching a possum and seeing a bat and wondering what the creatures made of her. And Jin likened himself during evening walks to a small, watchful animal. And Lucy didn't like to talk about mysterious connections between people and animals. But then later she longed to have a sense of an animal. Is there something there, or was I just reading into it?
Oh, no, there's definitely something there. I grew up in Hong Kong and in apartments, and we didn't have any pets when I was growing up. And yet my two novels both feature pets. So I think there's some kind of fascination there for me with pets and animals more generally. I think especially if you live, as a Lee family does, in in a city kind of environment, very urban, it is easy to even forget about nature and to become very caught up in our human, idiosyncrasies. And I think animals are a wonderful reminder that we are part of something bigger. And so I like using animals in my books to, highlight the absurdity sometimes of human beings' behavior. But the other thing that particular to Fiver and the rabbit in the book is that he has this unknowable quality to him. Again, different from cats and dogs, who you might know how they're feeling through their, wagging of a tail or purring. Rabbits are quite difficult to gauge. They have this unknowable quality. And I thought that was also quite revealing, in terms of these individual characters. They are also unknowable to each other at the moment. And I think also it speaks to, human being interactions, in that there is a core in each of us that is and always will remain unknowable to everyone else. And so we might pretend that, our loved ones, we know their deepest, darkest secrets, but of course we don't. And so that kind of reading and looking for subtle signs and behaviors, as the Lee family does with the rabbit, is kind of what we do with each other as well. So much of what we do is unspoken, actually.
I mentioned the rotating points of view earlier, but there were also some interstitial sections from, I'm assuming, maybe the rabbit's perspective. Talk to me about those.
Yeah. It was important to me to include a few little pauses away from the family, because I think it is quite a claustrophobic environment. The novel, it all takes place in the house, really. There are a few departures from the house, but for the most part, it is. And the grief is itself claustrophobic. So I wanted to give the reader moments of relief from that. And it made sense to do that by taking the reader into the rabbit's perspective. And it's not really... I'm not anthropomorphizing the rabbit at all. It's just there are three passages told from the rabbit's point of view, but a very distant kind of point of view. And they also kind of break up the book into rough three acts as well. So it was helpful from a structural point of view. But my main reason for doing that was to give the readers a little bit of a pause, a moment for reflection. Kind of, if it was a film, it would be that kind of panning out, and giving a broad perspective of the house and the environment.
As you mentioned earlier, in addition to being an author, you are also a doctor. Does one profession inform or influence the other?
Very much so. And I think particularly because I'm a what we call a general practitioner in Australia, which I think may be a family physician in the States. So I see, people over a long period of time, and I get to know all, aspects of them. I like to practice a holistic kind of medicine. And so people do come to you as a GP with the stories of their illness, and you come to know them as a whole person. And it gives me insights into worlds that I wouldn't otherwise be privy to. And you know, if anything, the what I take away from that is that we are much more alike than we are different. But it is really a privilege to have people disclose things to me that, you know, they've never disclosed before. And so, of course, while I don't write about those experiences because it's patient confidentiality, the insights I gain definitely do help inform my work. And with regards to the burrow, you know, I have seen patients who are living in the aftermath of a terrible tragedy. And so I've seen how even years later, as the Lee family are, you know, four years down the track, that they're still living with their grief. Even though the world has moved on, they still think of their loved one every day. And that was part of the reason I wanted to pick up this story at that moment in time, because I wanted to tap into that they almost feel like a guilt around not having moved on yet, because that is something that I've observed in not just patients, but also friends that have unfortunately been the victims of such a kind of sudden, unexpected loss.
One of the lines that I marked in the book was definitely about medicine or biology or anatomy, but it felt very nuanced. In the case of keloids, the skin didn't know when to stop forming scar tissue. It grew thicker and more gnarled in response to the mere memory of trauma. And then another one, Jin, who is an ER doc, he was in quarantine for 2 weeks and he was worried about atrophy. The line I marked was this: he often found himself impressed by both the human body's capacity for resilience and its seeming determination to die. That just seemed like a couple of the many instances where I assume it's you bringing in your knowledge of medicine and just putting such a beautiful, lyrical, literary spin on it.
Thank you for that, Beth. I think when you do medical training, it can be so cool and so clinical, but in fact, a lot of the things that you learn about the human body are so poetic and can have great symbolism. It's not taught in that way, but it doesn't take much to kind of just step back a bit and see, you know, how it has wider implications. And yeah, I think there's another, you know, scene in the book where Amy's remembering some of her lectures from medicine, in particular a Charcot's foot, which is, you know, a limb that has lost all sensation. And as a result of that, it doesn't feel any of the kind of just, you know, incidental knocks and bruises. And in the end, because of that loss of sensation, it ends up as this kind of bloody pureed mess of an appendage. And she kind of reflects on that being how she feels, because the grief has had this kind of numbing quality on her. And so she's not even registering the kind of small wounds that keep happening to her in this post-accident life. I know it's a heavy subject matter, but to me as a writer, it's quite fun to explore the poetry of some of these, you know, medical conditions. It can have really great metaphorical uses.
Do you have a hope of what readers will take away from this book?
I have really enjoyed reviews that have focused on the hopefulness of the story. I don't want readers to be put off or fearful of the pandemic setting or the heavy subject matter of grief, because I think at its heart, this is a story of healing. It's a story about a family that has suffered unimaginable loss, reconnecting with each other again and becoming receptive again to moments of joy and wonder.
Well, the book is The Burrow, Melanie Chang, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth. It's my pleasure.
That was Melanie Chang, author of the book The Burrow, which was published by Tin House. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Goulet.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.